Welcome to the Vent Room, where respiratory therapists can come and get a little inspiration. I'm your host, Dr. Tabitha Dragonberry.
All right, everybody. I am very excited to have some guests this week. I don't have one person. I have two. We have Jenny, is it Opalinski?
That's correct.
Oh, yay. And Barry Ransom. So we are talking today about the partnership between respiratory care professionals and speech language pathology. And one of the things that I've always said about healthcare, I kind of look at it as a beautiful symphony. Like I kind of picture the doctor as the conductor of the symphony. And there's just so many interdisciplinary skills that we specialize in, but we all have to work together to make beautiful music. Right. And that's what today's topic's going to be about. So before we kind of get into it, Barry, tell me a little bit about yourself, what you do and where you're located.
Sure. I'm Barry Ransom. I'm the program director for the Bachelor of Science in Respiratory Therapy program at Rowan University in South Jersey. I've been a respiratory therapist for 26 years. Educator for over 20, and I'm also the president-elect of the New Jersey Society for Respiratory Care.
That's great. And Jenny, what about you?
Hi. So my name is Jenny Opalinski. I am a medical speech therapist. So I have been practicing for a little bit over 10 years and mostly in acute care. For the last 6 years, I've been working at an LTAC where I am the only speech therapist, and my team is a lot of RTs, and I'm so grateful for them.
Well, LTAC with one speech, that's probably a big challenge because we have so many issues, right? Yeah. When we're dealing with speech, we're dealing with food and aspiration and all kinds of other things. So when we're looking at this interdisciplinary approach, when we're talking about like speaking valves and lung exercises, what do you guys see as the most important dynamics that make it successful? Because ultimately we're wanting to improve, you know, patient outcomes and keeping them involved and excited and seeing results.
So I'm going to play off your symphony analogy a little bit. And I agree. So if we think about it, maybe I'm approaching my patient from my speech therapy point of view, and I'm working with them to better, you know, the strength of their muscles that they use for swallowing. But is that going to be a really good, like, holistic take on getting this person better? You know, and do I know everything in relation to how these muscles are maybe related to breathing or what you do and how these different things might interact with each other? Probably not. And I think as a medical professional, we can never say that you do know everything, because constantly there is new research coming out. We are learning. And when we learn from each other, I think we can approach a patient more as a whole, as a person. You know, we want to rehabilitate them with the goal of getting them back to doing all the things that they were doing independently, or as many things as we can possibly get them doing, because that's what they come to us for, right? They're sick. They want to feel like themselves. They want to feel that independence. And if I'm working on the one thing, you know what? Maybe that one thing is connected to something you're working on. And maybe if we work on it together, maybe we can do it better. And maybe we can make it more relatable for the patient.
Yeah, I know that I quote this one a lot. There's a book by David Epstein called Range. And what he says is, you know, if you put a room of, let's say, all doctors or a room of all respiratory therapists, they're all going to look at the situation from one angle. But when you start mixing different types of people with different ideas, you get those diverse perspectives and you're able to look at it from a different perspective when you're talking to somebody and they're giving you their ideas. And ultimately, it creates right. That better outcome.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and I think it's about communication and respect for other disciplines. And I think that, you know, unfortunately, by training to this point and some other factors, you know, when we work, we tend to hang out together with other respiratory therapists. And so, you know, understanding what Jenny's role is and how that interacts with my role is very important. And then communication, you know, say I'm going, it's a day to wean that patient. And, you know, I haven't told Jenny about that and she has other plans. So, you know, there's an opportunity there for us to coordinate care and for the best possible outcome for the patient.
I agree. Like when we're working with people, we have to to make sure that, you know, our plan is in line with maybe the bigger plan, or, you know, we have to deviate. So with that, just saying, hey, this is my thoughts today. What's your opinion? And respecting each other's like professional opinions, mm-hmm. and sometimes finding that happy medium where it's like, oh, I don't want to push them that hard. But if we don't push them, you know, if you have 100% extubation rate in your unit, you're being way too conservative, right?
That's absolutely right.
Yeah.
So I think it's important to you know, communicate, you know, what's going on. And maybe I looked at or saw something, noticed something in the chart or in the patient's files that Jenny didn't, or vice versa, and she can point something out. Oh, listen, this, you know, this is going on. Were you aware of this? And this may affect weaning. This may affect, you know, passing your speech valve trials and whatever else. So that communication is very important.
Yeah. And I do think that sometimes we have to deviate, right? Healthcare is not black and white. A person's health is not black and white. You can have two people with the same diagnosis and they are very, very different, and you cannot approach their care in the same way. So if I have a patient, I want to know everything that I can possibly know to help them, right? That's why I'm here. That's why I do this job. That's why I do this work. And I can't know everything. So just like the attending doctor consults all these different specialties to give them a whole picture, and you take a step back when you don't know something. But when I don't know something and it relates to what I'm doing, I really want to learn something. So how am I going to learn? I need to talk to you. I need to understand what you're doing. You know, it is your specialty. I don't want to kind of step on anybody's toes, but I want to know what's going on, because that's going to help me be better. And I think I came...
You know, that same patient, we look at that patient through the lenses of our experience and, you know, our training. And yeah. So we may see the same patient with the same diagnosis very differently. And so sharing that with each other, you know, promotes a better patient.
And I think
Go ahead, Jenny.
I came from larger hospital systems where the departments were very big, right? So speech was speech and RTs were RTs, and everybody kind of had their territory. And we, of course, had rounds and we talked to each other. But when I moved to this LTAC where I was the only speech therapist and I had all these ideas and I wanted to start all these programs and I wanted to do all these things that I could not do by myself, it kind of forced me, you know, administration was like, cool, that's a good idea. See if you can get everybody else to buy in. So, you know, at first everybody was like, oh no, here she comes again with another idea and another thing for us to do. And I got pushback, and it's like, you know, the usual, this is not how we usually do things. We've been doing things. It's fine. Why do we need to do that? I'm like, well, let me tell you, you know, here's my list of research and here's what we can do. Why don't we just try it? And then eventually things started to change and we were working together. We were doing trainings together. We started the respiratory muscle training program. We started and we are a center of excellence for passing mirror with the inline speaking valves. And there is, I have to tell you, such a mutual respect now that has like really grown. Every day when I come in, I check in. You know, I check in with the RTs, the PTs, the OTs, and we're like, hey, what do you think about this patient? Or, hey, we have this new admission. Are they ready? You think they're ready for a PMV? You think I can feed them? Well, I'm going to decide that ultimately, probably as a speech therapist, but I want to know what you think, because maybe there's something you're seeing that I might miss, just like you said.
Yeah. I mean, we are, no one's sitting at the bedside all the time, right? Exactly. So we do a lot of consulting, right? We go visit our patients. As a respiratory person, when, you know, sometimes they'll call when things are going the wrong way, but you get that period of time, you have communications with the family, you build rapport. And from there, you know, maybe you get a little bit of information that somebody else didn't, because you have a better rapport with the family and speak with them. So working at a center of excellence in Passy-Muir and, you know, weaning patients to be able to use speaking valves, do you have a special approach that you guys kind of look at it from, or what lens do you kind of say, hey, you know what, this patient, we're gonna push them a little bit today?
So I think that is also not a black and white thing. That is a very interdisciplinary thing. That is something that we really talk to each other about. And because we have been working together for a certain amount of time, and because every new hire gets trained really well in these aspects, there are certain things we're looking for. So we have our policies and procedures. We have our, you know, criteria for inclusion. We have our exclusion criteria, which is equally as important. And then we have our patients who are human beings, and sometimes they're having a bad day. And sometimes, you know, something else is going on and it's not the time. And you wouldn't know that from looking at their chart or maybe even looking at, you know, the numbers on the screen for reading their vitals. Sometimes it's something that you just have to kind of sit down and talk about and approach. So yes, we have hard stops. Yes, we have things that say that our patients are ready. And I can go into them specifically, but they might be different from facility to facility. PASSIMER does have great resources. I do not work for them, but they have a lot of free education that is available to everybody. So if you go on their website, you can find that, and you can actually find all the centers of excellence on there. And you find they have very often their policies and procedures out there to things like inclusion, exclusion criteria. So if it's something that people are thinking of starting in their facilities, they are very supportive and there are a lot of resources available for that.
Well, and I think that's great for people to know, because sometimes you don't know where to start. And I didn't know that I've been in the field for a while. I didn't know that PASSIMER actually had identified you. There's criteria that you can work towards to be a center of excellence. So yeah. I think that that's a great start and say, hey, these are these resources. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, it's making you a better clinician, your team better, and also just making it better for patients.
I get tears all the time, right? Because you think about these patients who are, it's so scary. You don't have a voice. You cannot communicate what you need. You know, like you put their speaking valve on and all of a sudden they can talk to their family, and their family like will call a family member, guaranteed tears. You know, for me, for the patient, for the family, people, everybody, we're all like crying because it's a big deal. It's a big deal. It's a piece of them that they don't have. I had one patient who said to me, not having a voice is like not having a soul. I was like, that is very intense, but he's like, people walk by you and you can't tell them what you need. And that really like that hits, right? Because you give somebody their voice and their means of communication, and that is a little bit of them that you're giving back, and that's a big deal.
And it helps you know, with their improving ventilatory muscle strength and all those kind of things. And I can tell you from, you know, 25 years of experience, one of the most frustrating things is taking care of awake ventilated patients, and I have never learned to read lips, and so it's just, you know, so difficult to communicate with them, and it becomes frustrating for the patient. So, you know, giving them a tool and if they're ready to put that in. Yeah. You know, I've done things where I knew the patient was on minimal support and sort of disconnected them briefly, deflated their cough, and sort of held my hand over their drink, and they're shocked, like, what? Is that my voice? And so this is a much safer way to do that. But, you know, the same goal, you know, giving the patient back their voice and means to communicate.
And how scary must it be, I'm sorry, if you don't understand, right? You don't understand what happened, what's going on, you're in the hospital and you can't talk and you think your voice is gone. Like that's very scary.
Yeah. I know for I always worked pediatrics for most of my career. And then also when babies get their first speaking valve and they cry for the first time and the parents get to hear their child cry for the first time, much older age than normal. And that's how babies communicate. And for them, it's a piece that's missing because that's what you're expecting. That's what you're needing to know when they want things and they're just silently crying. And you have to look at them to be able to identify that they need something, or, you know, they cry and they make the vent alarm or whatnot. So on your teams, when you're working, you know, you have, your MD, your respiratory therapist, your speech pathologists, nurses, OTs, PTs. How do you make sure that communication, like we said, communications is such a big piece. How do you make sure that the message gets across to the whole team? Is it primarily patient care rounds? Is there anything else or any tools that you're utilizing to get everybody on the same page? Because I know we're busy.
Yeah, we're busy. We happen to be a smaller facility. We're 22 beds. So that makes it a little bit easier than being in a large hospital system. You know, we know each other very well and we see each other all day. So we frequently stop each other passing by in the hallway, like, hey, did you work with this patient today? What happened? What did you see? What is going on? How are they feeling? What do you think? I'm planning to do this. You know, we do round every week, but we also have things like, we have a PMV checklist that is in the electronic system that we chart on each patient, and everybody can see, you know, we see when we put the PMV on, we see when you took it off, we see what the secretions were like, what their voice quality was like, and then we see what their vitals were, and we see why you took it off, because that's important, right? If I'm putting the PMV on, I can just kind of go and click in and be like, okay, well, RT tried it yesterday, and the patient could do it for 15 minutes, for an hour, for whatever it was, and they had to take it off because the patient was desaturating. So what does that mean? Maybe they had a lot of secretions. Maybe sometimes it's positioning. You know, it could be the trach is still too big. Maybe they need to wait till they're downsized. But that's a lot of good information for me going in when I'm going to place the, you know, place the speaking valve today. That's what I'm going to look for.
Yeah, I worked at a larger facility that was a trauma center. We had patients, and we had developed a policy that for any new speaking valve order, dual consult was ordered. So the respiratory therapist would have to go evaluate the patient and the speech language pathologist. We didn't have any formal communications, as the speech language pathologist, you know, obviously there were fewer of them. They kind of came around when they needed to. But if I was on the floor and I knew that they were there, I would seek them out and make sure I consulted with them and talked to them about the patients. And the vice versa, they would find us and, you know, what's going on with this patient? How are the secretions? Those kind of things. So does it look like they're aspirating? And so we would communicate that way.
And I think it becoming more comfortable with the idea of kind of, you know, oh, that's our team. They're doing what they're doing, and not approaching them, because you'd be like, oh, we'll wait till you're finished, and then we'll go in and do what we're doing. I think kind of having a little bit of a different approach to it. Maybe, okay, I see the RT, so I'm just going to stop them. I'm going to stop them and I'm going to talk to them, because you know what? Whatever they're going to tell me might benefit me. And also maybe I can share something that can be of help to them, because at the end of the day, like I said, we're approaching this patient as a whole person, as you know.
I needed to add to a point that Jenny made earlier. You know, I've always been curious about what other people are doing with the patient I'm taking care of. So if I see somebody new, I'm like, oh, hi, who are you? What are you doing? And so then we would talk about, okay, well, I'm doing this. Oh, okay, well, let me tell you about this and this kind of thing. So there's always opportunity, but you just kind of have to seek them out and, you know, stick in your little silo and wait till they're done. Yeah, so it's a lot of opportunity, but you have to be willing to work with others and respect other disciplines.
And I think what, you know, education as a respiratory educator and things when we're looking at this is we are now trying to promote more interdisciplinary education. And I think by being able to do interdisciplinary education within the training environment, we stop seeing those silos, because if we can work together with speech language pathology while we're in school and nursing and these different disciplines that we will work with 100% when we're in the clinical area, because even like with respiratory chemicals, I feel like you kind of, as a student, get siloed with that therapist, and maybe you get to interact with some other people, but it's not to the extent that I feel like you do when you're a practicing respiratory therapist. So I think that educational programs are definitely trying to promote that more. And I was always one of those people's, hey, you know, what do you do? How does what I do affect the patient affect you? And how does what you're doing affect me? And having those communications and understanding that whole person. Cause I remember one time I was in the ICU and I was a clinical instructor at the time, and I was talking with my students, and there was a brand new, like, new grad nurse, and she's like, wow, you know so much about nursing. And I'm like, no, I know about my whole patient. It's not nursing versus respiratory. There are things that nurses do that respiratory therapists don't, and vice versa. But it's understanding that whole approach is we are treating a whole person. Yes, we are experts in, you know, lung, cardiac, and kidneys, and understanding how all those body systems work. But there are other experts that have spent just as much time learning other parts of the in systems of the body, and we all need to work together to provide amazing patient care.
And lucky for RTs, everything is tied to breathing. You know, we're weaning these patients off the ventilators, and like literally everything comes down to like how are they coordinating their respiration? Are they able to, you know, do this? And it's all tied together, right? It's such a basic function. And if somebody isn't doing that, it can affect so many different things. One of the other things that I do is I work with Aspire Respiratory Products, which is a company that makes respiratory training devices. And so the goal and my work there is really to collaborate with medical professionals to provide educational opportunities. Because it's a trainer for respiratory muscles, it does tie into so many things. And so I'm very acutely aware, reading all this research, how many different things it does affect, right? Because training those breathing muscles, helping with the respiration can help and affect, you know, there's COPD, Parkinson's, swallowing, just really endurance, everything. It's amazing.
Oh, and then preparing for the joint presentation Jenny and I gave at our state conference, I was surprised to see some of the benefits of activatory and inspiratory muscle training. It's a lesson in incidence of sleep apnea and all kinds of different things.
And lots of
even respiratory reserve for asthmatics, and just it's amazing. And you know, in the program that I went through and the one that I taught for previously, we really didn't have the time to go into that type of training, but it is something we'll definitely look at for this.
I think it's a newer kind of intervention. You know, inspiratory muscle strength training came about in the 70s, and then expiratory muscle strength training came about in the 90s. So there is really a fair amount of good research out there. But I think it's not something that's very mainstream. And it's such a nice opportunity for that interdisciplinary work, because you can kind of address so many different goals with the training that we've really used it in my facility to kind of do that.
And I think you highlight an important point for practicing respiratory therapists, respiratory therapy students, is that we always need to be reading research. We need to be looking at what's coming out. Because yes, it might have started in the 70s and 90s, but nowadays, it takes a while. Like, we have more data to sift through now, but really also learning how to read the research to be like, okay, this was a good study the way they did it, versus different studies and the different approaches, and, you know, understanding the quantitative and qualitative different data sets. So I think pushing yourself, if you're somebody who doesn't understand research, it can be daunting, but just learn little things and being able to translate that to be able to say, you know what, this abstract, it's super interesting. Is it worth my time to really dig into the whole study?
Right. And not there any bias involved in this anything? On a more basic level, why do we do what we currently do? Where is the evidence? Is there evidence to support that? And is there evidence for change?
Yeah. I think that's why
And that's why our board exams get reevaluated every 5 years, because there's always something changing. If you took your boards back when they were oral boards, the title volume requirements for that are totally different than what we're teaching and
one
doing
meter.
Now.
I think even, you know, my clinical practice today is so different than it was 10 years ago. And it's because of what I've learned and what we know. And, you know, for when I first started practicing, I remember the manager of the RT department was like, we have to keep the cuff inflated when the patient eats because it's going to prevent aspiration. And so, by the way, now the current research supports keeping the cup deflated because it can affect the safety of the swallow. But also, if anything is getting on top of that cuff, it's already below the vocal cords. So it's already aspirated. What happens when you deflate that cuff? It's going to go down, more than likely, right?
Big one. You know, we started using the speaking valves relatively late in the game. I was surprised that often patients that required oxygen while they were, the cuff was deflated or inflated on the ventilator or just on an aerosol tray collar, when you put the speaking valve in place, it restores their natural function of their airway. And often they need less oxygen. They are able to clear secretions much better.
They build up those pressures, right? So even just like being able to cough to clear those secretions a little bit is more effective because you can build up that pressure to have a better cough.
Well, it's the body's going back to homeostasis in the sense of it's going back to its natural function.
It's creating some of that pain, right?
Right. And then also
more effective than anything we can do to support.
Exactly. You know, we support people through their disease process, but ultimately it's always, okay, let's get them off the ventilator because we know that's breathing opposite than what natural breathing is. Let's get them talking by using speaking valves to get the voice the way it's supposed to be. Let them communicate. And that also helps with, you know, it's a myriad of things. Mental health, right? Being able to communicate changes and give somebody that opportunity of like, oh, people can understand me now. So that whole approach or that humanistic approach to just taking care of patients is always important. Now, what would be, as you know, we have a lot of students that listen, we have a lot of, you know, there's all kinds of different practitioners and how long they've been in. What would be your advice in either getting started with saying, hey, you know what, let's get better and try to be a center of excellence. What are the things that it's required to kind of start that journey?
So in terms of being a PASI-MUIR center of excellence, they have all those requirements written out on their website. But in general, I think too, if you wanted to start that journey to become more of an interdisciplinary sort of center or providers, I think having conversations really, and I know everybody's really busy, right? Medical professionals are very busy. The doctors are very busy. You don't want to take their time and you feel like you're being a little bit annoying when you're approaching people sometimes, but I think it's important to advocate for your patients. And if this is going to be a way to provide better patient care when they don't have a voice, you have to be their voice. So you have to kind of take the step and talk to people. And guess what? Maybe some people will not listen to you. Maybe some people will give you a hard time. That's okay. You know, I always think I'm like, okay, well, I'm not doing this for myself. I'm doing this for whoever is in room, you know, 706 who really needs that help and who could really benefit from us kind of looking at them together and going in there and being on the same page, because that's really important too, right? We have our specific goals, but even in goal planning, sometimes you need to really step back and talk to that patient and be like, well, what are your goals? What are your family's goals? Like, what motivates you? What is exciting for you? Like, what do you want to get back to doing? And guess what? Motivation also plays a part in them getting better, right? Giving them something like even the respiratory muscle training. And you know, the weaning process is like, okay, well, we're going to try to wean you and we're going to see how you do on this next mode. And if you can't do it, we're going to put you back and then we'll try again and see if you're ready. And I had this one patient and I gave him a respiratory muscle trainer. And this man slept with his respiratory muscle trainer because it was something he could do, right? He's like, I'm doing PT for my legs and I'm doing these exercises for my swallowing, but what can I do for my breathing? What can I do to make that better? Because nobody wants to be on a ventilator. Nobody wants that tube. So giving them something to do and then talking to my colleagues, being like, hey, look, this is what we're doing and this is why we're doing it, you know, it makes sense that you can do it too, because this also targets the skeletal, the respiratory muscles, which are skeletal muscles, so they can get stronger. And maybe, you know, there's research supporting that it can improve breath support. So maybe that can help you in PT, or maybe that can help with a stronger cough for airway clearance, for secretion management, for RTs. You know, so we can all be kind of approaching this a little bit more holistically.
And I think in terms of getting started working interdisciplinarily, I think that I would recommend start small and work your way up. You know, it is so easy to stick with that respiratory clan, and you just, you know, hang out with them and ask each other advice about patients when we really should be talking about other disciplines. I think, unfortunately, a lot of institutions, respiratory therapists are not on the ICU committee or other, you know, committees that they can be on. They just aren't. And so, you know, starting small with, you know, see Johnny said, hey, how you doing? What's going on with this patient? What can we do to work together to make it better? And then you include other disciplines. You know, it's curiosity, respect for other disciplines, and understanding that they all play an important role and how much better that can be for your own discipline if you work together for the better patient.
Yeah, I think it's that respect. And I think it's a compliment. If I have somebody from another discipline coming to me and asking me a question about the work that I am doing, like I'm flattered. I would love to tell you, you know, and thank you for coming to me and considering my opinion.
I think we, in general, like this is beyond respiratory, people like to talk about themselves. So like when people come and say, hey, you know, tell me about what you do, it does get you excited about what you do, what you're doing, educating. And with that, I think it's super important to just listen and take it in. And when we're working with others, come from that angle of curious. Right. So I think if you go from that angle of curiosity versus going, you know, I guess a lot of people do get defensive when you ask questions. Right. But if you come from that curious angle, you know what, I'm curious about it, it comes off a little differently than, well, why do you do that? You know? So I think that those are some really great advice.
Or
I say, generally, respiratory and critical care geek. You know, I'm the one hanging around to watch them chest tubes and those kind of things and asking the nurses about the drips and drip rates and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, I love it. PT, OT, everything. I'm always talking to them about what they're doing, and it strikes up a conversation at a minimum, and that's a start.
Yeah. And I think having that kind of student mentality all throughout your career, being open to learning something new, being open to doing something differently, is a great thing, because you never know when you can learn something that will help you do something better.
100%. Well, guys, I think that was a great conversation. For those out there, be curious, right? Just ask questions, ask other clinicians, learn as much as you can. And ultimately, we need to be advocating for that person that's in that bed or that room and that family, because every day, that's healthcare is a service field, but just a little different.
Exactly. Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.